Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann. For almost 50 years, our understanding of depression and anxiety has been defined by the serotonin hypothesis, which positions a lack of serotonin in the brain as the root cause for these disorders. To treat this chemical imbalance, doctors have prescribed selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. These drugs boost serotonin levels to alleviate depression. Today, SSRIs are the most commonly prescribed class of antidepressants on the market, but a new highly publicized meta-study has thrown their widespread usage into question. Dr. Asfaz Aftab is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Case Western University. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Good morning.
Dr. Aftab, I touched briefly on during my intro. Can you please explain the serotonin hypothesis?
I would clarify what's going on, and I would slightly disagree with something you said. So one thing is that we discovered the use of antidepressant medications somewhat incidentally by chance in the late 50s and 60s. We recognized that there's a class of chemicals that has beneficial effects on mood. And as investigators studied what these chemicals do and why they produce the effects on moods that they do, one of the hypotheses that was investigated at that time was that they have effects on neurotransmitters, in particular serotonin, as well as other neurotransmitters, norepinephrine and dopamine. And some of the researchers at that time hypothesized that maybe depression is caused by a deficiency of these neurotransmitters in the brain, in particular serotonin, and maybe the medications are correcting that deficiency by increasing the levels of these hormones. That was the hypothesis that was presented in the 60s, early 70s. And as research was conducted, it became pretty obvious by 80s and 90s that hypothesis was not true, because there was no consistent evidence of there being low levels of serotonin or any other neurotransmitter in individuals with depressed brain. But at the same time, study after study continued to show the clinical benefit of the antidepressants. So there was, unfortunately, what happened was that the public understanding of what these medications do and what depression is did not change. And in fact, in the 90s, through a series of direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising, this idea of chemical imbalance kind of took on a life of its own and became reified in the public imagination. So we have had this state for the last four decades where the public has this idea that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance and medications fix that. But researchers have known for a while, for quite some time, that's not true and that the actual picture is much more complicated. So the new study kind of reaffirms, that finding, and it became so much more explosive because of this general public understanding of chemical imbalance.
So Dr. Aftab, that's a lot of information. Could you break it down for us? How has the serotonin hypothesis promoted the use of the SSRIs?
Well, this was the serotonin hypothesis, in general language, it got turned into this buzzword of chemical imbalance. And I think everyone, in the media, magazines, advertisements, doctor's offices, it became like a catchphrase to explain the rationale for the use of medication. The primary care physician might say that, this medication fixes a chemical imbalance, or that's what people would talk on the media. So that's how it was explained, but the scientific rationale for the use of antidepressants was never based on the serotonin hypothesis. It's based on thousands of clinical studies in which we recognize that antidepressants have therapeutic effects, and we also have research that points towards different sorts of mechanism of actions rather than correcting a serotonin abnormality. Now, it is the case that these medications do do act on serotonin. So there is some sort of a complicated relationship between actions on serotonin and the effects on mood. But that is not quite as simple as saying that there is an abnormality of serotonin that is being corrected.
So what does this new meta study really tell us about the use of SSRIs?
Yeah. So to be honest, clinically, it doesn't, because it doesn't look at antidepressants at all. The new study has a very narrow question in mind. It looks at individuals with depression, and it's sort of like it looks at all of the studies that have been done, and it tries to see, do we see any abnormality of serotonin or not? So that's the direct question. It doesn't even look at antidepressants. Now, but the way the study got publicized, and because the general impression in everyone's mind is that antidepressants work by correcting a chemical imbalance, the story in public's imagination became about antidepressants, but technically the study has nothing to do with antidepressants.
So this isn't new information.
Not new for researchers and scientists, but new for the public in a way. Like I said, you know, like public has had this sort of what I call the folk idea. Some people call it an urban legend. The public has had this idea of chemical imbalance, which they have been exposed to for 3-4 decades. So it's new information for public in that sense, and it's causing a lot of confusion, and people are wondering what does that mean. But it's not new. It's not new information for researchers in the scientific community.
Okay, so I'm super confused. So SSRIs, are they effective? Are they not effective? What is it really saying?
So SSRIs are effective. They are effective. We have sort of like, you know, other studies verifying that. This new study doesn't say anything directly about SSRIs. This new study basically talks about the relationship between abnormal serotonin and depression. So, you know, it looks at depressed individuals, see if there are depression abnormalities. And it says that we don't have good reasons to think that that the serotonin levels are abnormal in individuals with depression. But that doesn't mean that the medications don't work. That doesn't mean that the medications are not effective. Let me give you sort of like an example. So consider a patient with heart failure. And that patient with heart failure has a lot of fluid accumulated in their body. And we give them a diuretic medicine, which is a water pill, and that acts on their kidneys and sort of like, you know, it relieves the fluid overload. Now, there's nothing wrong with the kidneys. Everything in kidneys is functioning fine, but we are acting on the kidneys to produce a therapeutic benefit. Something similar might be going on with the case of antidepressants, that we are acting on the serotonin, and by acting on the serotonin, we're producing desirable effects, but that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with serotonin by itself in depression.
So why is this study receiving the pushback from the psychiatric community?
So it is because sort of like the study has been used by some individuals and groups who are very critical of psychiatry as a way of saying that antidepressants don't work, or that the medical community has been lying to us about how they work. So it has been sort of weaponized as a way of questioning the clinical use of these medications. And it has been weaponized as a way of questioning sort of like their efficacy, safety, and it has generated that debate. And in some circles, there's this sentiment that they have been lied to, and then this lie has been exposed. But as I said, it's more of a situation that the research community has known something for 3 decades, but there's a disconnect between what the research community knows and what the general public understand. And there are multiple reasons for why that divergence has existed. But this study has very prominently exposed that divide. And that's why the general public has so many ideas, and they're so confused about it.
So what is the ethical component of prescribing SSRIs if we don't know why exactly they work?
So that's actually a very common situation in medicine, but we don't know exactly how most medications, I would say many medications work. I mean, even common medications such as Tylenol, we don't quite fully understand. So that by itself is not does not prohibit the use of medication. What is essential is that in clinical trials that we do, does it show a beneficial effect in clinical trials, and is it proven to be safe in those clinical trials? And that has been the case for antidepressants for after in multiple sort of like, you know, studies and over many years. And that's why, you know, these medications receive FDA approval as well. What I would say is that I think the main lesson for patients as well as clinician is that, especially for clinicians, is that, you know, when they're prescribing these medications to patients with depression, they should not rely on this sort of simplistic language that this medication is correcting a chemical imbalance, because that is not correct. And then the study shows that's not correct. In fact, we should be honest about sort of like, you know, the reasons we are prescribing these medications. And right now there's nothing conclusive. You know, scientists are still investigating how these medications work. One hypothesis that has received a lot of attention in the last 10-15 years is that these medications work by increasing the number of connections between nerve cells in the brain, and they increase the ability of nerve cells to sort of like form new connections and reorganize the way they are arranged. What the technical term for is neuroplasticity and neurogenesis. So there are hypotheses that are being investigated. Nothing conclusive, but we have some ideas of what might be happening. So I think the lesson for clinicians here is that instead of relying on vague buzzwords like chemical imbalance, which sort of like further perpetuate a lot of confusion and misunderstanding, clinicians should openly acknowledge that we don't exactly understand how these medications work, but this is what we know from clinical trials. And they should also emphasize that depression, it's a complex and heterogeneous disorder. We have recognized multiple different causes of that. There is no simple cause of depression. And that's a very essential component of, I think, the patient interaction, is that when clinicians diagnose someone with depression and they offer treatment, they should offer them an accurate understanding of what is going on rather than a simplistic understanding.
But does a meta study like this help or hurt a person's willingness to seek professional treatment for depression and anxiety, because there is so much mixed information, and then your study comes out like this, say, questioning if they actually work?
I think because the study generated so much confusion, I think because of that, some people might be more hesitant to receive treatment with antidepressants now, and people who are already on antidepressants, they might due to the confusion, they might want to get off the medication. And in that situation, I would say that I would again emphasize that the new study has nothing directly to say about antidepressants. It was looking at something else. I would say talk with your doctor, talk with your clinician, talk with your psychotherapist, and discuss with them sort of like, you know, what the current state of scientific research on the causes of depression and the mechanisms of antidepressants are, so that this confusion can be clarified. And like I said, to everyone who is hearing, this study does not challenge the efficacy of antidepressants. We know from independent other studies that antidepressants are effective. And it also does not sort of like say anything about the other mechanisms by which antidepressants may be working. And as I pointed out, we do have other ideas about how these medications might be helping patients with depression.
Dr. Aftab, quickly, the increased scrutiny surrounding SSRIs, does it mean that we're going to dig a little deeper and try to find more research and try to find other alternatives to treating depression and anxiety?
That actually has been going on for a long time now. We recognize that these medications are effective, but they don't help everyone. And so there has been a push to investigate other medications and other compounds. And so in recent years, for example, we saw esketamine, a new medication that was approved by the FDA. And currently there are trials going on with various sorts of psychedelic medications that have not yet received FDA approval, but are being investigated. So we are seeing a flurry of activity in sort of like discovering new medications and bringing them to the market. That is certainly the case. But at the moment, antidepressants, as far as medications go, remain the first line treatment of depression along with psychotherapy.
Dr. Avas Aftab, a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Case Western University, thank you so much for coming on All Sides.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll discover what else coffee is doing to our bodies besides getting us going and keeping us awake. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann Fisher. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams, in for Ann Fisher.
Gala, you're cute this morning, sweeter than a morning snack. Guess who would like some brew and make that coffee black?
That was John Pizzarelli singing the morning sentiments of many people who begin their day with a cup of coffee. The lines of customers at Starbucks, Tim Hortons, or your favorite coffee shop shows how popular the hot brown liquid is, not just here, but around the world. In addition to getting us going and keeping us awake, what else is coffee doing to our bodies? We're posing the question to Thomas Merritt, a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Laurentian in Sudbury, Ontario. Thomas Merritt, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
Let's jump right in. I love coffee. So many people love coffee. There are Starbucks everywhere you look around. There's a Starbucks on the corner. What are some of the common additives in coffee today?
So that's a really great point. It's not an additive. So this is a natural beverage, and it's a complex beverage. And I think the first thing that probably jumps to everybody's mind when you say a cup of coffee is caffeine. But there are about 1,000 molecules in that cup of coffee, and each one of them potentially brings something to your body. And that's really the interesting question that you know, medicine and science are trying to tackle, is what else is going on in that cup of coffee?
So what's driving the pendulum swings into the health status of coffee? Because one day you hear it's good for you. One day you hear that it's not really good for you. Just have one cup, just have a couple cups. What should we believe?
I think what you should believe is common sense. And that cup of coffee is absolutely going to wake you up in the morning. I mean, there are something like 2 billion cups of coffee consumed every year. And that's not a coincidence. It's because it's a great wake up. And the caffeine is what's waking you up. And we understand quite a bit about why that caffeine wakes you up and how it wakes different people up differently, which is really interesting. But I think that the other health benefits are largely wishful thinking. And honestly, the best that we can hope for out of that cup of coffee is it's not killing you nearly as much as many of our other bad habits. And it's not. It's not a health drink, but it's not an unhealthy drink. But it is a great way to wake up in the morning.
Well, do you expect that we'll find some new shocking information on coffee's effects before it's too long? I mean, because we get new studies all the time that indicate that something is good for you and something is not so good for you. Are we expecting something new?
No. But I think what we're going to find is that antioxidants are good for you, and they absolutely are. So as a living being, as a living organism, you are creating cellular waste just with every breath that you take, and that waste has to get scrubbed. And one of the ways that your cells scrub that waste, clean up that waste, is with antioxidants. They're naturally occurring, they're in your body, and they do a great job. Can you make them better with diet? You absolutely can. Are there antioxidants in coffee? There absolutely are. But are there better ways to get antioxidants? Yeah, there really are. So, you know, if you want to eat healthy, have a bowl of blueberries, have some broccoli. But if you want to wake up in the morning, have a cup of coffee. There are a lot of antioxidants in coffee, but really probably not enough that it's influencing your diet as much as you can do with other things like a healthy, varied, complex diet that includes things like berries and broccoli.
What are some of the other health benefits that coffee gives us, though? Come on, give me something to hang on to here.
Yeah, well, I'll try. But honestly, a lot of it's because we really want it to be good for us. And I will tell you, as a species, we are delusionally optimistic. And, you know, we love that cup of coffee, and we would love that coffee to be better for you than it is. There are things that it does. It's absolutely a vasodilator. Caffeine actually works really well with some painkillers. If you take your bottle of Tylenol or acetaminophen and you look at the ingredients, a lot of painkillers include caffeine. And we don't necessarily understand the molecular mechanism as well as we might, but it just works. And so when you take a painkiller like acetaminophen or ibuprofen, it works a little bit better if you have caffeine in the mix. And I was a little surprised by that. So, you know, I was looking at these painkillers thinking, okay, is it really like a wake-up thing that, you know, caffeine improves your mood, so maybe it makes you feel like you've got less of a headache? There's actually really good scientific research that says that caffeine actually makes those painkillers work a little bit better. There's really wonderful research saying that antioxidants will decrease the rate of cancer. There's some research that associates more sort of moderate coffee drinking with lower rates of kidney disease and some cancers. it's absolutely not going to cure cancer. And are there better ways to limit your risk of cancer? There really are.
So does it really matter, though, if the coffee is hot or cold?
It doesn't, which is super cool. And it also doesn't really matter if you put a limited amount of sugar. So if you put a cube of sugar, maybe a little bit of cream, you're not making it particularly worse. You mentioned something about coffee. I think you mentioned something about coffee drinks. I'll tell you one way to make it really horrible is to, well, one, make it taste horrible because you could add anything to it. But you can make it bad for you by adding a lot of calories. And so I think one of the real issues that we're going to be looking at is as coffee increases in popularity, if what also increases are a lot of the high calorie drinks, that's not good. And I think there's also an argument to be made against some of the energy drinks, especially in young people. There's not a lot of research suggesting that they're safe. So you get a lot of calories, you get a lot of caffeine, and that combination is not a good combination.
Well, you mentioned caffeine, and the major drive for drinking coffee, obviously, is caffeine. But what risk can you go over that again? Does caffeine present alone?
Yeah, so what's the risk of caffeine alone? So in a cup of coffee, very little. It's not impossible to overdose on coffee, but it's really, really, really hard. I mean, you would have to put a lot of effort into it. That's not true of some of the caffeine drinks, where the amount of caffeine could be an order of magnitude, could be 10 times higher. So, if you drink too many espressos in the morning, and I've certainly been there myself, you can get a little jittery. If you pound back too many of these energy drinks, you can really put yourself at risk.
So as we talk about that, how does coffee compare to other caffeinated beverages? Because a lot of them have a lot more caffeine than coffee, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's the thing to look out for. Coffee is simply roasted coffee beans that have been steeped in water, whether you steep it cold or hot, whether you do it under pressure with espresso or you just pour over near boiling water. You're going to get caffeine. You get enough caffeine to wake you up, but you're not going to get enough to put you in medical danger. A lot of the energy drinks, however, that's not the case. And there's a lot of caffeine in those energy drinks.
The Red Bulls and things like that you're talking about.
Yeah, and things like the Monsters. And honestly, I'm way too old to be too familiar with these. I'm the wrong demographic for these. But I recently just was part of a high school program at my university, and I noticed the high school kids are just pounding back these Monsters. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, in moderation, they're fine. But high school and moderation are not two words that you often associate with each other. And that's where we start getting some real messy complications.
You mentioned antioxidants. We need to, I guess, kind of stress that, because that is the really good part of coffee, although you say it's not in large amounts, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. So there are substantial amounts of antioxidants in coffee, and that's why people keep going back to coffee and looking at it for the health effects. But there are a lot more antioxidants in other foods that you could really consume, could eat, whether you're eating them or drinking them, specifically to boost the antioxidants in your system. You're not going to get a huge boost from a cup of coffee. You're going to get a substantial boost from a cup of blueberries.
And your research looked at how these antioxidants can influence cancerous cell growth. Do those antioxidants have a measurable impact? You said no, to the point that it's not a lot at all?
So, well, a couple of things. One, my research is actually in fruit fly metabolism. Mm-hmm. But when I talk about fruit fly metabolism, I don't keep people's interest. I read a lot of research in things like coffee metabolism. And if I want to talk to people about how important science is, I have a much better chance of getting them to be interested in that cup of coffee than in the fruit flies that are buzzing around their fruit dish. There is a lot of really good research showing that antioxidants limit cancer risk. There's some research that says coffee drinking in moderation is associated with lower levels of cancer. But those are the research that sort of goes back and forth. It's like the red wine diet. Is red wine going to make you live longer? It probably isn't. Is coffee going to cure cancer? We know it's not. Is it associated with longer lifespan? In some cases, but not all studies have shown that.
So when you talk about inventing new drinks, additives, ways of consuming coffee, it seems like what we're looking for, like you said, the high school kids, we're looking for that big push of caffeine content. And that's something that we're definitely not trying to push towards, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I will give you a really good use of coffee, though. And this is something that came out in recent research that I was very surprised by. I'm a napper. I'm in my mid-50s, but I've napped since I was in my mid-20s. And there's a lot of research that shows that naps are really good for you, and we should all be napping. So middle of the afternoon, take a 15-minute nap. Naps are really good when they are something like 15 or 20 minutes long. Well, it takes about 15 or 20 minutes for a cup of coffee to really kick in. And so there was some really brilliant research that showed that having a cup of coffee right before you take a nap optimizes that nap because it helps you wake up 15 or 20 minutes later. And I thought, you know, I'm pretty skeptical, but looked at the paper, did a little napping research of my own, and I think this is a brilliant use of coffee. You know, you want to be able to nap, but you also want to be able to snap right back at the end of that nap and get back to it. And that cup of coffee pre-nap may be exactly what the doctor ordered.
So are you telling me I need to drink a cup of coffee before I take like a little power nap and that I will likely wake up 15 to 20 minutes later?
I am telling you that is the one medical result that I am 100% behind. And I 100% am telling you to have that cup of coffee, have an espresso, take that nap, and you'll have a better nap for it.
Thomas, I'm going to take you up on that. So let's talk about how do you take your coffee, Thomas?
So I've got about 100 coffee makers. I got to be honest with you. So one of the things about coffee is coffee making is a hobby. It's a ritual. It's a thing that people get into. I have black coffee in the morning. I usually have a pour over coffee. I take a couple of minutes, honestly, to center myself and make a pot of coffee. And it sounds a little bit silly, but it is my morning meditation, and it does it for me. I also have a little mocha pot. And I drink a lot of mocha pot coffee. I find that one's just super easy, and it's a good pseudo espresso. But I also play around with different coffees and different ways to make coffee. How do you like your coffee?
I like my coffee with a little bit of coffee and lots of cream. So I know I'm saying like all the wrong things, but that's pretty much it. Probably like 5 creams and in my coffee along with a Splenda.
So just be gentle on yourself with that, because that is a lot of calories in that cream.
I know. I have to fight somewhere else, but that's kind of like the one thing. But I don't drink it. I don't have to drink it every day. So, you know, just a little bit of here and there is okay. Moderation, right?
Absolutely, moderation. I had a really interesting conversation with another scientist who's into coffee, grew up in Portugal. And one of the things that he pointed out that was really interesting is that coffee drinking is more accepted at a younger age in the part of Europe that he grew up in than it is in North America. And I think that part of that is that they're drinking black coffee. And so kids are 8, 9, 10 years old are having a cup of coffee in the morning in a way that we might really look at it sideways in North America. But I think part of it is a cup of coffee and a cup of coffee with a lot of cream are two very different beasts.
Very different. And I was always told if you drank coffee as a young person from my parents, it would stunt my growth.
So I had the third person that was on this panel having this conversation was a woman scientist who's been working in coffee a long time. And she said, you know, I've heard that my whole life. And I've got to tell you, I'm 6'2". So I will tell you as an adult male who's been 5'11 and a half since he was 16, I don't think the coffee really got me, but at 6'2", I'm pretty sure that she was saying that coffee was not stunting her growth.
That's pretty funny. So it sounds like you don't limit your daily coffee consumption at all.
I drink more coffee than most people, but I'm conscious of the amount of coffee that I drink. And so it's what, 4:30 my time. I'm unlikely to have another coffee at this point. I got up, had a cup of coffee with my mom this morning, went out, sat on a beach and made a pot of coffee. And then my daughter and I had a coffee after lunch. Or I had a coffee, she had an ice cream. So I space it out and I really shoot for 3 or 4 cups a day, which I think is a pretty good sort of moderate amount of coffee. And there are days that I have a lot more than that. And there are days where I'll have 1 or 2. I rarely skip a day, and that would be an interesting exercise. There is some very good evidence that shows if you drink coffee quite a bit or more than average all the time, that you will get headaches and things if you don't have coffee. And I need to play that game, try that experiment, and see what happens if I skip a few days.
Well, I definitely have friends who rely on coffee, a couple teachers, and it's like a morning routine, And without the coffee, if they try to skip a day, they do get the headache. I've had that from two or three different friends tell me that, but I don't have the addiction they have, so I can skip a day.
Yeah, and so there are a couple of layers to that that are really, that comment that are really interesting. If you gave them a cup of decaf, like a good decaf, and didn't tell them that it was decaf, they may or may not still get those headaches. A lot of the effects of caffeine seem to be exaggerated if we believe them. So caffeine is one of the few drugs that's actually approved for use in sport. So it's a legal enhancing drug, and there's quite a bit of evidence that shows in some kinds of endurance exercise and some weightlifting sort of high burst energy stuff, that caffeine actually does help athletic performance. But in those studies, if you told the athletes that you were giving them caffeine supplements and they believed that the caffeine supplements made them faster or stronger, they were faster or stronger. So there is a definite placebo effect in coffee. And I think that's true not just in sport, but in some of the health effects as well.
But I think some of the weightlifters and things that I've talked to, they do take a cup of Joe before they go lift. And I think maybe it's placebo or maybe it's the caffeine. Something about it makes them think that their workout is going to be better or more effective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. Caffeine definitely has an improving influence in some sport events, but it also seems to work better if you believe it's going to work better.
So overall, if you're telling someone, you know, about coffee, do you think that it's a thing that you just basically say, if you like coffee, coffee's fine, but just don't overdo it? I know some people and have known some people, I've interviewed some people, 10 cups of coffee a day would be too much, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, we started this by my comment that common sense goes a long way. I wake up in the morning, I have a cup of coffee. And part of it is because it does help you wake up in the morning. And part of it is because I really like the ritual of that cup of coffee in the morning. That kind of approach to coffee, I think, is pretty smart. I mean, it's my approach, so I'm a bit biased. But, you know, I wouldn't tell somebody to start drinking coffee for the health benefits. I would tell people to start drinking coffee because I think it's a lovely beverage that's a lot of fun to make and is a good way to wake up. But I wouldn't tell them that it's a health supplement.
Thomas Merritt, a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario, thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Very educational. I feel better about my coffee drinking habits now. And I think that a lot of people will too. Lots of good information. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're back in a moment.
I'm up, so grab your cup and let's have coffee. Lots of coffee, shots of coffee, pots of coffee. Oh, make that coffee black.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Natasha Williams in for Ann Fisher. 70 patients died as a result of mistakes in organ transplant screening by the U.S. Organ Transplant Network. This information was released by the Senate Finance Committee this past week as the committee's investigation of the system concluded. The United Network of Organ Sharing, or UNOS, is taking a lot of heat. Dr. Rio Hirose is an abdominal transplant surgeon at the University of California, San Francisco. He's held multiple positions in the UNOS committees and is the current director of the Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients. Dr. Hirose, thanks for joining us on All Sides.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Could you please give us a short rundown of what makes up the U.S. Transplant Network?
Yeah, so in the 1980s, there was an act that was passed by Congress called the National Organ Transplant Act, which set up a national system to coordinate both organ donors throughout the country and organ transplant candidates, and set up a contract called the OPTN, or the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, that really coordinated what was a random sort of non-system, and created two entities, what's called the OPTN and the SRTR, and I'm the surgical director of the SRTR. But those two entities were responsible for, one, the coordination of all the organ transplant candidates with the deceased donor pool that was occurring in the United States. And back then, we had very few transplant centers, much fewer liver transplant centers, for example. And now that the transplantation system has really boomed, we're a little bit of a victim of our own success. We have now hundreds of transplant programs that need to be coordinated with about 100,000 candidates on the wait list. It's a very complex algorithm that we need to try to coordinate. Anytime a generous family comes and says, yes, my loved one who is now deceased or close to dying, I'd like to get donate or help get give the gift of life and get those organs to the next most appropriate people. So that system has been set up over the last 3.5 decades and continues to evolve. And we face some logistical and other challenges with the system. But I have to tell you that overall, the transplantation and donation system in the United States is a model for the world and is really quite an impressive accomplishment over the last 3 or 4 decades. And again, transplantation has become much, much more successful over the last 3 or 4 decades. And we have an increasing number of deceased donors every single year, year after year, over the last several years. So there are definitely challenges and problems with the system. And I'm the first to not only point that out and admit it, but point out some areas for improvement. But I think the audience needs to understand the background of this is that we have an incredible system of both transplantation and organ donation in this country. Are there areas for improvement? Absolutely, yes. But I think that needs to be put into context.
So when did UNOS become involved as the lead of the national transplant system?
Well, they have held the OPTN contract. They were the first ones to hold the OPTN contract, which is administered through HRSA and the Department of HHS. And they continue to hold that contract through multiple renewal periods over the last 3.5 decades.
So what other groups contribute to the network?
Well, the network is a membership organization. In other words, UNOS is comprised of its members, which include all the transplant centers in the entire country, that is every transplant hospital, and they participate, as well as every single OPO, which is short for organ procurement organizations. There are currently 58 OPOs in this country that the entire country is divided up into what's called donor service areas. And there's an individual OPO that's responsible for anyone who is passing away at any hospital to approach families and to coordinate organ procurement and make the gift of life or organ donation possible. So that is divided up into various different OPOs. And the OPTN or UNOS, who holds the OPTN contract, is responsible for coordination between those OPOs and transplant centers, and is also responsible for setting organ allocation distribution policy in this country.
So what is the state of the transplant wait list? Any improvement in the outlook of the wait list times? Because you hear from time to time, or you see on social media, folks who are kind of using social media as a way to try to find help and get people interested in donating their organs and that type of thing, you know, or signing up at least for the donor list to make sure that, you know, folks in the time of distress, you know, don't have to make a decision like that.
Yeah, you know, it's still there's a fair gap between the demand and the supply of organs in this country still. And so if you take, for example, kidney transplants, there's about 90,000 people, 90,000 to 100,000 people waiting for kidney transplants. And there's many fewer transplants done in the United States. So there's a fair amount of disparity in the United States as kidney transplants go. In some areas of the country, people wait 2 to 3 years for a kidney transplant. Other places in the country, you wait 8 to 10 years. But the wait time is terrible for all those candidates. And so the solution to that is multifactorial. And one of them is to encourage living donation, where, you know, a loved one or anybody that is willing to donate one of their kidneys can donate to their candidates, whether they know them well or not. And that is one way to try to ameliorate this long waiting time. And unfortunately, many patients on the list die while waiting for a transplant. So every donated organ is precious, and we try to use as much as possible every single quote unquote usable organ. That doesn't mean that every person that dies has an organ that is should be used, because some folks actually don't have very good kidney function to begin with. So there are going to be a number of people who pass away and are willing to donate their organs, but they're not going to be utilized. And based on the judgment of transplant centers and other professionals, that this may not be the best organ for that particular person or for anyone.
Well, a major point of grievance in the report was the fact that the screening of transplant organs was not done properly, leading to the spread of disease from donor to recipient. What exactly goes into the process of screening organs for transplant?
That's a really good question. So, we would love never to transmit a disease from one human being to the other through an organ donor, through a donated organ. So there have been cases where we meaning the transplant community, has unwittingly transmitted diseases such as rabies or West Nile virus or other diseases. These are tragic occurrences and sometimes result in the death of the recipient that received these organs. In response to this, UNOS and every OPO does a lot of screening of every single organ donor. They screen every donor for HIV, for hepatitis C, for hepatitis B, and for many other diseases. But whenever you take an organ from one human being to another, if they've passed away, and you can't necessarily detect every single cancer, every little cancer cell that might actually be in that person's body that we don't know about, and we might unwittingly transplant a disease from the donor to the recipient, we do as much as we can to try to reduce that risk. If someone has a brain tumor, there is going to be hesitation of using that person's kidney or liver in donation. But if you try to get that disease transmission to zero, what will happen is that you will reduce the number of organs that are available for transplant. And some of these risks are fairly small. In fact, the number of disease transmissions that you're talking about is minuscule compared to the number of lives that you save by transplanting some of these organs. Some of these conditions are not known at the time of donation. So if you want to reduce the transmission of diseases to zero, you have to balance that out by all the organs that may be completely non-utilized or wasted because of this fear. So it's not so simple. We're always in a balancing act. You want to try to use as many organs as possible and yet not transmit disease. So there's a whole committee based on how one is supposed to screen every donor. There's a committee called the Disease Transmission Committee of UNOS, and every single OPO is, screens the donors as much as possible by history, physical examination, X-rays, and blood tests to try to minimize this. But I would submit that that risk will never go to zero. There will always probably be some transmission of some disease that we may not even know about, a new virus, for example. And a good example of this is COVID-19. There's been one transmission of a lung transplant patient that got COVID from a donor that had COVID. And many of us were afraid to take COVID-19 positive donors. And the COVID-19 pandemic affected many donors. Now, if we turned down every organ that happened to come from a COVID positive donor, that would result in the non-utilization of a huge number of organs and probably result in the death of all those patients waiting for a transplant. That's not what we want. What we want to do is the most reasonable thing. And it turns out that most COVID positive donors, besides those that are donating lungs, are probably very safe to take. So one has to balance this notion, and much of the report or the Senate hearing was very histrionic and unbalanced. And, transplantation is a very nuanced field. You can't just say, oh, look how terrible it is. 70 people died because of a disease that was transmitted from organs. That is terrible, especially for those 70 patients. But if you try to tighten up the screening criteria and exclude more donors, what you'll have is a much higher rate of waitlist mortality and kill off more patients in the notion of trying to decrease disease transmission.
So you're basically saying in some cases, an undiagnosed disease at the time of their death wouldn't necessarily have been known. And so there's basically no way to know and would react, I guess, after getting into the body of the new person.
That's exactly right. And that's a risk anyone takes by getting a transplant at all. So when you sign up for a transplant, you know that you're getting an organ or tissue from some other human being. All the people involved in transplantation do their very, very best to try to figure out whether that donor may have a disease that can be transmitted to the recipient. And we would never knowingly use an organ that we know might transmit a disease, but sometimes those things aren't known. Someone dies of encephalitis of unclear etiology. It might be a virus that we don't even know about right now. Could we possibly transmit that disease to the recipient of those organs? Absolutely, we might. And that's a risk we take every time we do any sort of transplant, whether it's a heart transplant, liver transplant, kidney transplant. We do that in the spirit that we look at a patient that's facing us and knowing that they will die without the transplant. So is it worth the risk of me transmitting a disease that I don't know about to that patient? Yes, it is, as long as that patient understands they're taking that risk, along with many other risks of transplantation. Those patients have to be on drugs to suppress their immune system for the rest of their lives. That's a risk they have to take if they want a transplant. So unfortunately, transplant is not a panacea. It's not something that doesn't carry risk. It carries risk, and people should know about it. And yes, tragically, sometimes it results in disease transmission. But I would caution the community in thinking, oh, we can't go on transmitting diseases like this. Now, hold on. We actually want to minimize that risk, but at the same time, use every single usable organ we can to save all those patients' lives that are waiting for a transplant.
Dr. Hero say the Senate committee reported detailed issues, though, of organs getting lost en route. How does an organ get lost? That's a whole different ballgame.
Yes, that is a completely different question. And again, many things were laid at the foot of UNOS that perhaps should be thought of as the problems with the system, like, for example, an OPO that mislabels an organ, for example, or gets on a flight and sits in a cargo hold for many hours because the cargo area of that airport closes between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. It sits there until 5 a.m. until the cargo area opens up. Now, is that the fault of UNOS? I would submit it's the fault of the system. After 9/11, for example, before 9/11, a kidney used to be able to sit in the cockpit and be the first one off. And it never sat in cargo. But after 9/11, the TSA, the Department of Homeland Security, said, well, it can't travel on the airplane anymore there. It has to go in cargo. It can't go through. And so after the first class passengers and the coach passengers get off, the kidney, a life-saving organ, gets taken off as cargo. And again, cargo areas of different hospital, different airports may not be open when that package lands and has to sit there until cargo area opens up. That's not the fault of UNOS, for example. That's the fault of many, many things happening. I mean, you can blame it on Osama bin Laden, or you can blame it on Department of Homeland Security. But this is a problem with the system, and we need to fix the system. We definitely need to get more accurate tracking of our organs. We need to probably leverage a lot of other planes that are flying all around the country, manned by FedEx or Amazon, whatever. We need to fix this problem, but there hasn't been enough investment of time or money, for example, to actually create a national transportation work network that helps track our organs and get them from point A to point B in the most efficient way possible. Is that partially the fault of UNOS? Maybe, but it's also the fault of every single one of us that participates in the organ transplant system, including the commercial airlines. So I think that, yes, there was a lot of heat brought in the US Senate hearings. I'm afraid that it was laid at the foot of one organization. In fact, we
Okay.
have to think about the entire system.
Thank you, Dr. Rio Hirose. We're out of time. Abdominal transplant surgery doctor from California in San Francisco. Thank you so much for being on All Sides with Ann Fisher.